welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast Season 3, culminating with the Layer 8 Conference on Saturday, October 8th in Providence, Rhode Island. This season, we'll have conversations with social engineers and OSINT investigators who will tell their stories. We hope you enjoy them.
Welcome to another super exciting episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We have another great guest for you today. We have Eric Krohn. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me, Patrick.
For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell the people a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. I like long walks on the beach. No, I kid. No, my name is Eric Krohn, like you said. I've been in IT and security since like the mid-1990s. So a long time. I've earned the gray hair that I have, I promise. Lots of different fields. I've worked in healthcare, which was very interesting. I worked in aerospace machining, a pretty large place there. I spent some time with the Department of Defense. I spent about 10 years as a contractor with the U.S. Army at the, used to be called the CONUS TNOSC, or the CONUS Theater Network Operations and Security Center, because we have acronyms within acronyms in the military. It's now the Second Regional Cyber Center, Western Hemisphere. I ended up being the security manager there and saw lots of very interesting things on the security side, defending that network. So we did Active Directory for all of North America, along with the network infrastructure and all that kind of good stuff. So I thought about writing a book. It would have to be called Redacted. So after that, I spent a little time with everyone's favorite certification group, ISC Squared. If we have any CISSPs in the audience, at some point in time around 2015 to 2017-ish, you may have received a letter with my name at the bottom of it. Something along the lines of CPE adjustments and such. Sorry, wasn't me executing what the board said. But I've done item writing for the CISSP. I've done all that kind of stuff as a volunteer before working there. And now, lo and behold, I work for KnowBefore as a security awareness advocate, which is really a title, folks. It's also known as a technical evangelist in places. But basically, I get to go around and I get to share my experience with people and hopefully educate people that are new in the industry or can learn from the major mistakes that I've made throughout my career without having to make them themselves.
Yeah, as part of being the evangelist, you get to go around and give presentations, and you've even given a presentation at the Layer 8 conference. What was that one all about?
Yep. I love the Layer 8 conference. And I believe that one was on levers of deception sort of thing. Psychology. I'm very fascinated by the psychology of phishing and social engineering. Now, I'm not a social engineer myself. Okay. I just don't have it in me to do that. But the psychology still fascinates me. I spend a lot of time in airports, or at least I have. And in doing so, you see a lot of very interesting things play out with people in stressful situations and in uncomfortable situations. And it's always interesting to sit back and watch that and try to relate to what they're feeling. And then also tying that into just the social engineering part. When you see a scam going down, like, why did they fall for this? What's the things that play in this? So I'm fascinated by that side of social engineering as the I don't know if it's tech behind it. It's not really tech, right? But the mechanisms behind social engineering.
Do you do the same thing that I do? And this is just for fun, where you can walk around an airport and you can gather so much information about people. And even one of the scariest things that I've noticed about information that you can pick up, it's just people will have even their entire home address right on their luggage tag, which of course makes perfect sense if you're flying that you want that on there. But it's like all that information is right there. And if you want to, you can stand next to the person as they're talking or people are on the phone. You get an idea of where they're going. So it seems a little bit scary with all that information that's there, where you can get somebody's home address and you can see that they're going somewhere that isn't their home. Is that something that you've also noticed around airports?
Yeah, I've noticed stuff like that. And just people, I don't know, it seems weird. It seems like they trust me. I don't know, maybe it's not me, maybe it's everybody. But, you know, I was in the airport going to Nashville, I think, for a B-sides not long ago. And a lady came up and she's like, hey, do you mind watching this? This is my husband's medical equipment. I need to charge it. And she like plugs it into the little thing and then like disappears off to take care of her husband. I'm like, I don't know what this thing's worth or whatever, but you're trusting me with someone else's medical equipment, right? Like, I don't know what this means. But you see people doing strange things. And the other thing is conversations. People, so if there's noise, they talk loudly on the phone. So they may already talk loudly, but sometimes they're wearing earbuds and stuff too. So it gets even louder. And you can hear these amazing business conversations going down and people talking about, you know, I need you to take care of this. You need to call Paul over at XYZ company and have them do this because this is going on. And they're just oblivious to the people that are around them.
And you can also even shoulder surf. There's everybody sitting around using their computers. They're sitting on email and you can get so much information that way as well. And of course, I would never advocate for anybody to do anything malicious with it. Instead, I would flip it around and just want people to be aware of their surroundings. Anytime that I have to use a computer in an airport or even on the airplane, one thing that I always make sure is that I have the privacy screen on, which makes it extremely difficult to see the screen from any kind of angle. And I also make sure that there's no way for anybody to stand behind me. I will sit against a wall or against, you know, one of the windows that's two or three floors up, because you never know who could be behind you at an airport.
Yeah, and situational awareness is a big part of that, knowing what's going on around you. And it's not just at airports. I mean, you go to conferences. I see this all the time at conferences, non-security conferences and security conferences. For whatever reason, people just like let their guard down and they just don't pay attention. The other interesting thing about airports is you are inevitably in a place where there is an unsecure Wi-Fi that everybody's connecting to. So this is a fantastic time to throw in something like a Wi-Fi pineapple. And, you know, even if you push them a certificate and call it something that's related to that airport, they're going to go, oh yeah, this makes sense. Okay. Let's install that cert. Now you're breaking their SSL. It's just, there's all of these things that go on in that kind of travel. So it's an area ripe for very interesting stuff, if you will.
And there's probably really no way for airport security people to notice a pineapple that's been started up, because everybody creates a hotspot on their phone and you can see those popping up all the time as well.
Yeah. And that's a better way to do it, obviously. You know, I don't believe there's much in the way of security on the Wi-Fi stuff in these airports. I've never seen anything that shows that. Now, obviously, I mean, I've done things for fun where basically I've popped up a Wi-Fi pineapple. I've done this too in hotels, and basically just start gathering the SSIDs so I can show somebody at a conference, like, look, it took me, you know, half an hour to gather these 20 or 30 SSIDs. And if I told it just to emulate those, they're connecting through it, right? It's definitely a place that for whatever reason, people leave their guard down. Maybe it's the TSA. They go through the TSA. They figure everything after that's secure, right? I don't know. TSA makes me feel very secure. How about you, Patrick?
Yeah, okay. So I don't think any of that was what you came on here for anyway.
No.
I think one of the things that I was excited to talk to you about was how big that phishing is and how much of a problem that phishing is and how much that people should really worry about phishing. How big of a problem is phishing today?
It's huge. You know, business email compromise, one piece of it is one of them. I think 2020, the FBI said there was about 1.8 billion in losses just for 2020. From just the business email compromise side of things, which is huge. And BEC, it's also known as CEO fraud, depending on what country you're in. This is essentially a social engineering act. BEC is the wire transfer fraud, you know, where they set up a pretext and get you to wire a bunch of money off. There's also like gift card scams. We see those all the time. Those are happening. I hear so many stories. But things like payroll redirection too. I don't know if you've seen that, but they'll pose as an executive and have them change where their next paycheck goes, money out the door. I don't know about you. Some of these CEOs make a couple of bucks, right? But that's just in BEC, 1.8 billion in 2020. But then you get into like the ransomware stuff. So the number one and two ways that I see ransomware spread almost constantly is through email and through like RDP or remote access portals. It's always one of those two that takes first, depending on the study. And so we all know that ransomware is a big deal. We still see it in the news all the time. There's so many of these that happen that never make the news that we never hear about too, that's going on constantly. All that stuff is phishing related. And then you even just get into stuff like, credential theft, getting people to give up credentials, getting into their email boxes, stealing information. We've seen redirection of funds for down payments and stuff for homes. I mean, personal and commercial, all that stuff is for in one way or another linked back to phishing a lot of the time, or a majority of the time from what I've seen. And it's why I'm so passionate about trying to help people defend against it. Because frankly, it's such a simple thing when you think about it, but it's so effective because, you know, I think a lot of times people underestimate what is going on with phishing. So you say, hey, you know what? Phishing's a problem. And employees go, yeah, I know. I can spot those all day long. You know, it's the Nigerian prince, no big deal. And they completely underestimate what the adversaries are up to. And the phrase I always use, these aren't the kids in the basement eating pizza, drinking Mountain Dew anymore. These are very complicated, sophisticated, and mature organizations that are firing off a lot of these attacks. And if we could take a bite out of this, if we could slow it down, you know, if we could slow it down 20%, it would have a huge impact on cybercrime in the world these days.
Yeah, when I do phishing campaigns as part of my job, one of the things that I like to tell people is that I really do only have to be right once, because all too often when I'm doing a phishing campaign, I'm trying to fish for credentials. So as soon as I can get that one set of credentials that gets me into somebody's network, that's basically all I needed. So sure, all you other 99%, yeah, sure, you stopped it. That's great. Good for you. But the 1% that didn't is how that you can get into the network.
Yeah. And it's scary to see what happens. I mean, so that's a human problem too, is how we deal with credentials. And I feel for the end users, because as security people, what do we tell them? We tell them we need 15 characters, uppercase, lowercase, extra, you know, special this, that, the other thing, add some numbers in there for, don't use a dictionary word. And by the way, don't ever write it down or reuse it. And they can't be successful with that, right? So human nature is to figure out one or two passwords and use them everywhere. So once you get that username and password pair, to be able to turn that around and use it on other accounts, you know, the success rate on that is fantastic for most places. And also, if there's a data breach where they've used that somewhere else, you know, like a knitting forum is what I like to say. A knitting forum gets breached, they get your username and password there. Well, they're going to turn around, they're going to try it on Wells Fargo. They're going to try it on the credit card places. They're going to try it in email providers. They're going to try it everywhere. And it's a very successful thing to do with the password reuse problem. So yeah, that's another human piece.
And just to circle back to a couple of the points that you just made on some of those passwords, one of the things that I always liked to do when I could access a password database was also to pull out the history. Because once you start pulling the history, you get to see how people do change their passwords. And you do see that some people do increment their passwords. And that strategy on one pen test that I did one time was actually successful, where we had access to somebody's credentials, or so we thought, and we weren't getting in, but we did notice that there was a number at the end of the password. So we just said, let's try the next number. And it worked. That's what got us in. So you're right. If we're going to make it difficult on people to do this, we're going to see that they don't really always choose the most secure things. Now, you mentioned that on that knitting password dump that they're going to then test banks. What defenses do you think end users should be aware of so that they can prevent the attackers from getting into their bank account?
I mean, first and foremost, MFA, you know, use a unique password, but multi-factor authentication. Now, MFA is not something that's, it's not the silver bullet. It doesn't stop everything. There's ways to get around MFA. There's ways that people fish people out of MFA codes, which are pretty brilliant too, in some ways, right? But having that is important, where at least if you get a message that says, hey, here's your code, you go, wait a minute, somebody, you know, they got to understand what that means. Hey, somebody got in with my password. They're waiting for this code. I need to go change some things right now. That's one of the key things that I love about MFA, but also just making sure they understand that the reuse of passwords is just so dangerous. Don't do it on things like your banking account, especially. Now, I'm a big fan of password vaults. Like I said, we can't just expect people to be successful with all this, but man, password vaults, they're cheap, they're free, they're, you know, everything in between. One password, there's Bitwarden. I use LastPass. I use, you know, our family uses it actually, and it's fantastic. Under threat of death, I probably couldn't tell you what like 80% of my passwords are these days, right? Because I may never have seen them. We need to get people in the habit of realizing how important that side of things is as well with the credential piece. Also with social media. I don't know if you've seen this, Patrick, but social media, having accounts get taken over there is a nightmare. I don't know if you've ever tried to recover that, but I've had at least, well, there was one instance where I did a radio show in New York and the host had her Facebook account taken over. Her Facebook account was the one that was the admin for her her radio show account, okay? And as soon as they got in, what did they do? They changed the recovery password. They changed the recovery phone number. They changed all of that stuff. And so now all the recovery information was going to the attackers. And if you've ever tried to get anything done with Facebook, it is near impossible to do. And we fought with it for a long time. I finally got a hold of a human when I had her do we did a copyright infringement claim, which actually got their attention. Because I'm like, hey, this is your business. This is your stuff you're putting out as a journalist. Let's do that and say they're using your stuff. And that finally got a person who never actually fixed the problem anyway. So that account, personal and otherwise, was just gone.
Now, you've mentioned that phishing is relatively easy, but it seems like there's a good amount of work to figure out which platform that you want to use, to find hardware, to set up the software for the phishing platform. Are there easier ways that you're seeing that people are jumping into the phishing game?
Absolutely. Like other industries, this whole cybercrime side of things has been evolving and maturing. Like I said, not kids in the basement, right? So now we have all these as a service offerings. There's malware as a service, there's ransomware as a service, there's phishing as a service. And so there's services out there. There's frameworks to begin with. There's tons of different frameworks, but these services, one of the ones that caught my eye that just fascinates me is it's Bulletproof Link. It also goes by Bulletproof Link and Anthrax and a couple other things, depending on how you look at it. But this, it's the same product essentially, and they have a platform. And you can either buy a phishing kit from them, one-time fee, or you can buy subscriptions with them. That's over time as a service. And it's like bi-monthly, monthly, semi-annually, and annually, you can do these services. And there's options. So they can do essentially send all the phishing emails. They can host all of the like credential theft pages. So that's one of the things is, I mean, you got to go through and you got to figure out, okay, so I have access to this page and now I can put this credential theft page here and I got to just get people to it, right? But they host all this stuff. They gather credentials, they even share credentials amongst things. And it's all as a service. So they handle all of the infrastructure. They handle all of the stuff that you would need to do. And basically you can show up with a list of emails or email addresses and go, okay, let's send these. They have amazing dashboards. It's going to tell you stuff like marketing stuff. What was the delivery rate? What was the fail rate? How many were rejected? So you can clean up your list, right? They look at how many were opened or not opened. I mean, it's amazing how mature these things are, and they're not that expensive.
Yeah, when you see some of these things, it you would think that this is a legitimate business, which I don't know, maybe they are, other than the fact that you're trying to steal credentials. But, you know, there's probably an obvious line, but still kind of a fuzzy line between marketing emails and phishing emails.
You say that because I tell my marketing team all the time, y'all are creepy. And you use just like the same stuff that these attackers do, because it's true. It's the same tools. You're right.
And it's a lot of the same techniques. I've spoken to other people who ask, like, how do I get better at phishing? How do I learn to write good pretexts? And a lot of times the answers for those are, go look at the marketing emails. Go look at the subject line. What makes you click? What makes you open? What makes you then click on the links inside of there? So there is kind of that whole fuzzy area between marketing and phishing, because it's a lot of the same psychology.
Yeah, the difference is often intent, right? What do you plan on doing with this? Now, a lot of marketers don't realize that, you know, their job is a lot of social engineering. It's a lot of looking at the human factor and getting them to take an action, which is what basically, you know, your phishing is doing. It's trying to get them to take your intended action. They call it a call to action in marketing, you know, and they run A/B campaigns to see which things get opened more often and which don't. And that's all the same kind of stuff that happens in the cybercrime world. So don't tell these marketers, but they probably make halfway decent cyber criminals on the phishing side if they really put their mind to it.
Yeah, I've seen that there's even like help desks and phone support with some of these higher end phishing as a service companies as well. From what you've seen with the phishing as a service, do they even go as far as having the templates pre-set up? So that if, depending on what you want, like earlier you mentioned social media, Facebook, like what are some of the other typical targets that these phishing as a service might actually go after?
I mean, obviously they do have templates set up. Just like at KnowBe4, we have our platform that does the simulated ones. You can just pick from a list of things and go, okay, here you go. And it autofills and boom, it sends it out. They have the same thing for real phishing. I mean, it's legitimately like that. And we see a lot of, obviously, social media. There's a lot of value in social media accounts that people underestimate or underplay. But I also see them for even the BEC stuff, like the wire transfer stuff. I see all these templates for all kinds of different things. Credential phishing is a huge one. And a lot of these services, again, will host where the people go to. When they put in their credentials, it's obviously tucking them away. And they even a lot of times have the ability to do, to capture like the MFA codes. So I did a demo on this a while back for Ethical Hacker Network, I think, where I threw up a product called Mudlishka, and you could actually go through and basically what it does is it hijacks a session, but it goes through all of the steps. You have your username, password. I did this for Google. And once they log in, then it prompts them, you know, it forwards that, logs them in, they get the MFA code. And it's all done through a reverse proxy shell, but basically then it pulls it in, pulls their session. You just drop that in and voila, you're there. You're them. All of this stuff is set up in here so that basically non-technical people can play in a very technical game now, which is one of the things that scares me so bad about this as a service stuff that's going on is who this opens things up to.
Who do you typically see as that? Is that just anybody that wants to stumble across some kind of dark web IRC channel and can buy their way in? Is it as easy as that for somebody who has no background?
Oh, it's even easier in some cases, you know, like with Anthrax or the Bulletproof link, they have a website and ironically enough, you go to it and it'll pop up a 10% off your first order. I mean, talk about like marketing, right? And right. You can sign up for stuff all just right there. I mean, it's right there. All you have to do is be a little motivated to go look for it and say, hey, I'd like to play in this game. And lo and behold, it's not hard to find this stuff. So that's the beauty of it for them, again, is non-technical people. And I think about all the scammers and con people that are out there running around that are, you know, that are ripping people off all the time around the holidays and just in general, you know, Craigslist and all that. Now, if they can get into the phishing game, that opens a whole door to another group of people who, quite frankly, a lot of these are very skilled con people. They really are very good scammers. The bar has been, you know, the technology piece of things and having to run that on the back end. And for the developers is fantastic too. Because like, for example, in a ransomware as a service case, that's becoming huge, right? So they have these affiliates that actually, they do the attacks while the developers can focus on the product, on the infrastructure, making it better, making sure it's getting around EDR and filters and stuff like that. They can focus on all that and it frees them up to now run many more attacks. I mean, it all starts with you run out of resources. Like in a typical organization, you're like, well, I can do attacks or I can fix this, or I can do attacks or I can do that. And now all of a sudden they can back out of the, I'm going to do the attack piece, just focus on that. They still make usually about, you know, like ransomware as a service is usually or oftentimes an affiliate split. So it'll be 70, 30 or 80, 20. So the developer gets 20%, the affiliate gets 70 or 80% of the split, which is very motivating for them. But it's almost like a Ponzi scheme eventually of, you know, of this where they're getting 20%, but they're getting it from 30 different directions, which is way more than they could ever do on their own.
The phishing as a service seems scary enough where people are out there stealing credentials. And you also mentioned ransomware as a service. Where that is that up and coming? Is that getting even bigger? How is that compared to phishing as a threat?
So ransomware as a service has been around for a while. And frankly, more often than not, when I see strains out there, there is a ransomware as a service piece of it. It's an affiliate developer relationship. Okay. Some of them are more picky about how they get people. They may look for people that have, you know, done things and made a name for themselves and recruit them in. Some of them are less picky about what they do. And a lot of this you can get into on some of the open or on the dark web marketplaces and things like that. But if you look at it, I mean, for a while now, this has been the game. And even if it doesn't come out and say, this is a ransomware as a service strain. Like take, for example, when the pipeline got hit, Colonial Pipeline got hit by DarkSide, right? Before DarkSide was basically taken down, one of the things they released was they said, okay, we didn't mean to do that. That was not our intent. From now on, we will be approving any attacks before they happen. Now, that right there tells you this is an affiliate that got into that system and just said, yeehaw, you know, YOLO, and fired this off and, you know, scared them enough to take down their pipeline side because their normal network got attacked. But they realized that this brought so much heat on them. They said, okay, hold on. We're going to have to start approving this now. Now, they weren't around long enough to make good on that. You know, we all know they scatter to the wind and show up in different groups or whatever too. But that when you look at these attacks, a lot of times you can see the signs that this is absolutely a ransomware as a service piece. I mean, Revil, all those ones, it's all ransomware as a service.
And that's where I wanted to go next with you was the irony of ethics in ransomware. Because there... When you think about it, they kind of have to weigh out various scenarios where they're trying to get paid from somebody, and they also have all these threats. So one of the questions that I get asked sometimes is like, if I pay the ransom, is my data going to come back? Are they still going to release my data to the public? Am I going to get ransomed again in the future? Do you have any thoughts on those types of concerns?
I would say yes and no to every one of those. It could go either way. And I hate to be, that's almost like my contractor answer, right? Well, yes, no, maybe kind of, it could happen. Depends, right? That's the consultant contractor answer. But when it comes to things like, will you get your data back? The answer is most of the time, yeah. Yeah, you will. Now I'm gonna throw a wrench in that and say, do you trust that data? Okay. And here's where I'm coming at with this. And I haven't seen it happen yet, but this is my tinfoil hat. And I can tell you, if I was a cyber criminal, I'd be playing games like this. They have taken control of your data, all right? When they encrypt it, they've taken control of it. They've already been in there for a while because modern ransomware, it's not fully automated. There's a human element. They get in, they scope, they look, then they fire it off, right? But if I can get into, say, some of your databases, who's to say I don't change all of your payment accounts to one of my own? So I restore all your stuff. You go back to business, you start paying invoices, and lo and behold, it's dropping it into an account I own. I mean, I could do that, right? Who knows what happens to that data because they had control over it. Now, the other thing that happens is sometimes the data gets corrupted. And we got to understand when they're doing this compression stuff, it's all about speed, right? It's about getting as much as you can before you're spotted. It's a noisy operation, so they want to do as much as they can, which means a lot of times some of the safety things we do when doing encryption to check it is skipped over. So I've seen a lot of files that ended up corrupted during that. You know, you'll get a lot of it back. But you also asked about, you know, as far as reinfection, and that happens too. So the key thing with ransomware, and something I tell people is, if you're recovering from ransomware, please don't just like restore computers. Like don't go to your bare metal restore, put it back on there. Because essentially, a lot of times you're restoring the back doors they used to get in the first place. Okay, so over in Europe, I think it was the UK, there was an organization got hit with ransomware. They paid £2.4 million as the ransom and got everything back up. They're like, yay, we're working again. 30 days later, got hit, same group, same thing, another £2.4 million because they didn't figure out where they got in from and they didn't clean that piece up. So it's kind of messy recovering from ransomware. And I'm always very skeptical of the data that you get back and absolutely skeptical of, let's say they've encrypted your backups, but now you get your backups back and do your restores. Man, I always tell them nuke it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure, you know, reinstall the OS and then return the data, but don't just drop an OS back on. I might be a little paranoid on that, but I can tell you, I've just seen it go wrong too many times. To do otherwise.
And what are the best defenses against ransomware?
So the best defenses against ransomware is, frankly, because it's spread by phishing so much. That's a key part of it. Make sure your employees and your people are trained to not only spot, but also report phishing attacks so that you can go kind of take care of that for the rest of the org. That's a key piece of it is trying to be proactive. But you do need good backups. You absolutely have to have good backups and test them. Oh, for the love of all that's good in this world, test your backups. People are often surprised to find out that, hey, I thought I was backing that folder up. Or look, this database has been locked for 2 years and now we need it. These things happen all the time with backups. So make sure you test them. Also EDR, you have to have endpoint detection on there. Is it going to stop everything? No, it's kind of like the Hail Mary pass, right? It's the fourth quarter, 30 seconds left in the big game and you're just chucking one downfield. It might get it, but they put so much effort into bypassing EDR a lot of times that it's an issue. But then the other thing now with modern ransomware, something I didn't used to say, but we have to now is DLP. You have to have data loss prevention in place. Because with the, you know, since Maze started back in December of 2019, with the major exfiltration of data and then the threatening to dump it, that's a whole nother issue you're having to deal with now. And if you don't stop that data from leaving, it's not a pretty time.
Here's a question that I was asked recently, and I don't know the answer to this, and hoping that you do, is the FBI talks about various ransomware as a service groups as some being better than others. What would make some ransomware group better than others on according to maybe the FBI?
So I think the better groups are better about covering their tracks. They're better about getting into the system and then hiding for a while. Their recon is better. So they're going to look around. They're going to find the things that can really impact your organization the most, right? The power behind ransomware is that it takes an organization offline and they need to get back. This is why it's so powerful in healthcare and manufacturing, because you can't make widgets if your system's down. No doctor is going to perform surgery if they can't look at the charts and see what's going on beforehand, right? If they can't get that, they're not touching anybody. So it just stops business in those areas. So the more effective they can be at that, the more likely someone is going to be to pay the ransom. So by getting in, you know, they're doing all kinds of stuff when they get in these days. Like I said, they're scouting around, they're looking for stuff. I've heard reports of these groups where they've seen that they've gone and actually reviewed like cyber insurance policies. So they know how much you have available if it's time to pay out. They'll look at the bank records and go, okay, this is how much cash is on hand. So when we drop this thing, instead of just going, you know, the old Dr. Evil pinky to the lip, like $1 million. And they're going, you make more than that in a month, you know, they can go in and they can say, okay, so this is going to be $12 million. And we know that you can pay it. So that's what kind of, I think, differentiates the good ones from the bad ones, is their ability to do that and remain quiet until it's time to do it. And I always liken the modern ransomware is kind of like in the action movies, where the person's walking away from the building and it blows up behind them, right? It's like, that's what they do. It's the last thing they do because it's so noisy. They walk out the door, they pull the pin, they chuck the ransomware grenade over their shoulder, and then everything gets loud, okay? But until then, they tend to remain very, very stealthy and see what they can do, what they can take, what they can use, and how they can hurt you the most.
And is insurance the panacea for companies? Can they just buy insurance and then not have to worry about ransomware anymore?
That would be a big no, Patrick. So insurance too. I mean, this has been going on for a while now. The insurance, the cyber insurance market's been an interesting one. I did some talks a while back at a conference for insurers, and they were still trying to figure it out. This was, you know, several years ago, and they were getting better at it, but there was still a lot of contradiction between your typical crime side and your cyber crime side, and what would pay, what wouldn't. Sometimes the policies would actually counteract each other in some ways. And they started getting that good, right? But then with ransomware, it's really hurt them. So they're tired of losing money. And for those listeners out there, if you haven't shopped cyber insurance in a while, It's a shocking thing these days, how much it's increasing. I've heard at least double, triple, sometimes more for the policies, because the insurers are losing their backsides, or they just refuse to insure at all. And where in early days, they used to say things like, okay, we did an assessment, you got 90 days to fix these things, or you get dropped. Now they're going, we did an assessment and we're not insuring you until this stuff is taken care of. So there's a big change in some of the feel there. But as far as being a, you know, insurance is a transfer of risk. But ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, it's getting harder to get paid out. And it's just not what it used to be. It's not going to solve your problems. It may help. And one of the nice things I do like about the cyber insurance parts is a lot of times through the cyber insurance, you can get some legal counsel on what's going on. So if you get hit, you know, take advantage of those things. They also, a lot of times, will have groups to do the digital forensics on retainer. Folks that you can't just walk out and hire because, well, they're already booked on retainer for all of these people. But it may be something that you can get through those policies as well, which can be very helpful when you're trying to figure out how they got in and how to keep them from getting in later. So there is value in it, but it's never something that you can just go, you know, I'm transferring all my risk over to my insurance policy. It's a $5 million policy. We're good. And then you go sleep well at night, because that just doesn't happen these days.
Here's something else that I wanted to get your opinion on that seems kind of a little bit divided among people, is the value of phishing testing. And what do you see as the value there? And we can also talk about sometimes the discussion about using things like COVID pretexts. And even when you are doing the phishing testing, what are the important metrics that people should be looking for when doing the testing?
Yeah, phishing testing can be a little controversial. All right. So I want to lay this out there and say, what I look at when it comes to phishing testing, it is not a way to trick people. It's not, you should never be using it to make somebody look bad or feel bad. The way I look at the phishing testing is it needs to go hand in hand with training. When I've learned things, when I've gone to college and stuff, for example, or even in high school, you get the teacher that teaches you something. They talk about this. They show you this. They do whatever. And then if you do a lab, I learn from doing the hands-on. The fishing part, the simulated fishing stuff, we should really treat it more like the lab work. Okay. Here's a chance to try something. If you fail, you fail safe, right? It's not like you're going to burn down the organization. It's a safe way to fail and a safe way to practice these things. Okay. But to your point, there's also a lot of information you can gain in that. So when you first start a fishing group or, you know, a fishing campaign for an organization or a program, if you will, my advice is to go pretty broad on the types of fishing that you're doing, the simulated stuff, and find out where people are really vulnerable. Because you may find out that people never open a document and open, you know, and enable active content, but they may constantly give up credentials. So let's not waste a lot of the limited time we have training them and teaching them about not opening documents, because they got that, right? They already know what's going on with that. Let's talk about the things that are really a big issue within our organization. And I think a lot of people that do these don't take that into account and leave a lot of very valuable information sitting on the table where they could be using it to really improve their security on that. So the phishing stuff, I know it's controversial, but your mindset has to be right. Your messaging to the people has to be right. You know, this is not to make you look bad. You never, never publicly shame people. I am absolutely against that. You need to make sure that they understand that what you're teaching them helps them at home too, because scammers try to hit people at home. Hey, what we're teaching you, man, it'll keep you safe around the holidays when someone's got that PlayStation 5 for, you know, $52 because they just have to sell it immediately. You're going to be looking at that. You're more savvy about all of this stuff. So it benefits them as well. And then, you know, we have to make sure that our response to failures is something that's aligned with our culture, our business culture, for example. Okay. So that means you don't just fire somebody generally over failing. Okay. That I never agree with that. I'm very much a carrot over the stick sort of thing when it comes to this. Okay. So you want to help them. You want to help them figure out why it went wrong. You want to do all that stuff. Now, eventually, you may have to take actions because it is a risk to the organization. And after the sixth or seventh or, you know, whatever you decide culturally it's going to be, failure on a fishing test in a row, it's time to do something about it. Now, again, never, 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 never publicly. But maybe you have a talk with their boss. And you say, hey, can you help them understand why this is so important? Because by that time, usually it's somebody just going, I don't even care. I don't care. It's not a big deal. You know, they've got to understand why it's important. And then from there, you end up with a boss in HR. And then you got to go through steps. You got to give them every chance you're going to do. So I've seen some people take away their internet access for a while. You know, you get no internet. Sorry, but, you know, we got to protect things. So it can be controversial. Unfortunately, I think that a lot of people make it more controversial than it should be. And you brought up a point about choosing the pretext, like COVID pretext. Okay. That's a tough one. Your organization may have a culture, a good, strong culture that's looking at things going, I get why they do this, right? Like, I know the attackers are using this stuff. So they're not going to get upset if you pop one in that's a little more on the controversial side. On the other hand, if you have a culture that's not so open and forgiving, if you will, law offices, physicians' offices, things like that come to mind, right? Or education a lot of times, as opposed to a Silicon Valley startup. If you're putting out stuff like that, it may be truly upsetting for the people. And that's counterproductive when it comes to running these programs. So I've seen them do... There's been some major flubs out there where somebody sent out a bunch of stuff to people that was like bonuses after a huge layoff, right? I mean, come on, let's not be blind to what's going on. We have to pay attention to that. More often than not, I would say play it safe, play it to, you know, what a lot of times the usual folks are going to use, but don't go into the ugly stuff. Don't threaten people. Don't tell them they're going to lose their jobs, etc.
And what do you also think about reporting metrics of click rate versus report rate?
Yes. So reporting metrics, again, can be very valuable. Okay. Click rates don't tell you everything. They really don't. Reporting to me is incredibly important because there's a lot you can learn from the reporting. And, you know, it's actually threat intel that's fantastic. And now here's something that people don't think about with the threat intel that's coming in with users reporting phishing emails. This is basically the one time you can see what's making it past your filters. This is very valuable to know, oh, wait a minute, my filters aren't catching this stuff. Maybe I can tweak a little bit here because these are just sailing right through, right? There's a lot of information, and the stuff that makes it to people's desktops has passed. I mean, how many different checks in the typical organization? It's a ton of them. You really want to look at that and try to think outside the box with the numbers you're getting. But I think reporting that and the ability to go out and pull similar messages off of the email server is huge. So not everybody in the company is exposed to it or the organization. Like if you get 5 reports in 20 minutes, you know you're being targeted by a campaign. Go pull them off the servers. You know, shut down those messages before other people are exposed to it.
All right. This has been a really interesting conversation. I thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us on the Layer 8 podcast, Eric Krohn.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was fantastic. And I'm always interested in hearing from people what they think about this stuff too. So I look forward to the comments that we may get on this one.
Thank you for listening to the Layer 8 podcast. Please join us in Providence, Rhode Island on Saturday, October 8th for the 5th annual Layer 8 Conference. The Layer 8 Conference is a 501c3 nonprofit organization as designated by the United States Internal Revenue Service.